WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Maybe it takes someone not from New York to truly appreciate the mix of characters and sounds that inhabit that uninhibited city. Mark Singer was a young man from Oklahoma when he became a staff writer for the New Yorker magazine. The editor, Mr. Sean, assigned him to write Talk of the Town pieces. Those are the short, unsigned sketches appearing in the front of the magazine that rely on the voices of New York. Singer's collected some of those Talk of the Town pieces along with longer profiles in a new book called Mr. Personality. One of his profiles took us to lunch with the powerful motion picture and theatrical talent agent, Sam Cohn.
Physically, he is an odd combination. One often hears Cohn described as a fat fellow, but the characterization is inaccurate. Rather, he is an almost spindly man who, for the time being, out of a healthy affection for rich food and drink, elects to wear a larger person's midriff. His face has a squarish cast, and it also has dimples. There is a considerable gap between his front teeth. He has lank auburn hair that has now mostly gone gray. Despite this, he does not look his age, which is 52. He has a thin, crinkled mouth, a pink complexion, and blue eyes that can't see very far. Behind his eyeglasses, thick lenses in translucent, flesh-toned frames, he squints. The squint gives him a look that is a mixture of curiosity and amusement. If Cohn were less nearsighted, he could see the same expression on the faces of many people who know him well and are anticipating his next move.
That's a wonderfully honed description of Sam Cohn. Did it take you long to work that up? Did these images just come right into your mind, the image of a spindly fellow who elects to wear a large person's midriff?
I think those images probably come in uninvited, but it certainly isn't something that happens automatically. In other words, I would, as close to as possible, live with these subjects of mine. Certainly the longer pieces, I wouldn't move in with them literally, but I spend months and months in their company, in and out. Cohn was very accommodating that way, as were everyone has to be if they're going to be subjected to a New Yorker profile anyway.
How do you avoid from going over, if you spend several months following somebody around, watching their life, sitting in on their most private conversations, how do you maintain your writer's distance without sort of verging over into friendship or joining them in their jokes or offering advice?
Well, it's a very good question, and the answer is that you don't. You in fact, have a two-way street. You're invading their space, their privacy, and they have a right to know something about you. So while these don't become your closest friends, they do become friends. It's inevitable. And I suppose that means that I wouldn't end up writing a profile about someone for whom I had great contempt. At the same time, there's a distance that always has to exist, because ultimately I go to my little room and write, and then they're going to pick it up and read it in the magazine someday. The odd thing that I think happens in these circumstances is that you often end up protecting the subject from himself. People reveal a great deal. People like to... I've come to the conclusion that people like to be exposed. What you sometimes have to do is cover them up a little bit.
The profile pieces are about 10 times as long as the Talk of the Town pieces, which seem to be about 900 to 1,200 words, and you found wedding ring salesmen, stove repairmen, a zipper salesman. How do you find these people? Does somebody tip you off at a party and say, Mark or Mr. Singer, this is just the very guy you want to go after and do a little feature on?
They happen in every possible way. The stove repairman came to repair my stove. He walked into my kitchen. That was how I found him. The zipper man, someone told me about. And I actually think the wedding ring salesman I heard about because someone had heard about him on, of all things, a national public radio broadcast. And then things happened serendipitously.
I've always seen the Talk of the Town as some sort of a great anonymous chalkboard where just about anybody can come up and write something amusing or poignant or politically barbed. Does the anonymity attract you, or are you sort of breaking out from an anonymous pattern by publishing this book of anonymous pieces?
Well, that I treasure that anonymity, and so then that makes me sound like a hypocrite to have then put my name on a book that has some talk pieces. But these are 25 pieces out of maybe 250 that I've written over the years, and of talk pieces. And I just feel that it's a great gift. I like to be able to walk out in the city as a reporter and not as a person who's going to get in the way of the story because he has a recognizable byline.
Does your voice as a writer change when you write a profile piece that'll be signed then?
That's a very good question. I'd like to think at this point, no, that I've been at this for a while now and that my style is my style. But certainly when I started out as a Talk of the Town reporter in 1974, I was just 24 years old.
Which actually, in truth, sounds like every writer's fantasy job.
It was a good way to discover New York. I finally, about a year ago, had lunch with William Shawn, who had hired me, who left the New Yorker in 1987, and I basically had to satisfy my curiosity as to why I was hired. I was 2 years out of college, and I had never wanted to be a journalist, and wound up in New York and at the New Yorker, and Mr. Shawn hired me on what seemed to me virtually no evidence that I could do what I then was asked to do. And as it turned out, when I asked him why I was hired, he didn't have a very specific answer. He operated on instinct, and I'm very grateful for that. So I came to New York and started writing these pieces, and then not long after I'd been writing Talk of the Town pieces, I decided to write a profile, which is in this book, a profile of Goodman Ace. I was able to include myself in the piece, in the first person singular, occasionally, where it was convenient, and
in part because there was a distant relationship there by marriage,
right? An odd relationship. My Goodman Ace was at one time thought known as the dean of television comedy writers, but he really became celebrated during the 1930s, long before television. In the 30s and 40s, he was the writer, director, star, along with his wife Jane, of a radio program called Easy Aces, and Goodman Ace's sister married my grandfather, so while we were technically not blood related, he was my great uncle, and we were very close.
I have to tell you, in rereading your Goodman Ace profile, I realized it was you who gave me the basis of a story that I enjoy telling at restaurants, which is about the gendarme. There appears to be a holdup in the kitchen.
Right.
I mean, I'm favorite. Abbreviating the joke, but.
Well, we've told the punchline, but basically right. The waiter comes over after the patron says, "Gendarme, gendarme," and the waiter comes over and says, "Excuse me, sir, I believe you mean garçon. Gendarme is the French word for policeman." And he says, "That's exactly who I want. There seems to be some holdup in the kitchen." I use that all the time. I've never called a waiter anything but gendarme, and much to my wife's dismay, I might add.
One of the hallmarks of Talk of the Town pieces, and I think especially yours, is that there's an ending, not quite a kicker, but there's always a nice ending that wraps up, ties up together everything that's gone on before without it necessarily seeming like an abrupt the end. It tends to be a quotation from the stove repairman or the wedding ring salesman that kind of leaves you with a little smile on your face and like, weren't we fortunate to drop in and see this person? When do you hear that? Do you know at the time when you hear somebody say... like the wedding ring salesman trying to pitch a wedding ring. Okay, then, if you know any other fellows as foolish as you, send them to me.
Right.
Does that just sort of leap out to you as a closing sentence?
It usually does. And, of course, they don't always happen at the end of the interview. You know those lines when you hear them. Sometimes, of course, you hear more than one. And you say to yourself, how am I going to end the piece with this? I'd like to end it with that, and they're both great lines, but it's amazing how regularly there is one perfect ending